Okay, I want to share with you some ideas about Yom Kippur that I haven't yet really crystallized, but I think that there's something to think about as Yom Kippur gets closer. The concept of the afflictions, the five afflictions, not eating, not drinking, not wearing leather shoes, not washing, not anointing, not having marital relations, are not really afflictions, not the way the Rambam describes them. The Rambam describes them as a rest from these physical things, just like Shabbos. Shabbos, we don't afflict ourselves by not working, but we cease working to take a rest from it in order to put it into perspective. So too, it's a rest from these physical things to be able to focus in more on the spiritual world. And in that vein, the Meiri says that the mitzvah of eating Erev Yom Kippur, which Chazal say if someone eats and drinks on the day before Yom Kippur, it's like he fasted 2 days, is because the eating and drinking on Erev Yom Kippur is a preparation for the fast. And the preparation for a mitzvah is already part of the mitzvah. So preparing to fast is like fasting. But he explains, what does that mean? It's the preparation for the fast. The whole purpose of the fast is not to focus on your stomach growling or on being afflicted by staying away from these physical things. The purpose of the fast, like we said, is to take a rest from these things so you can focus in more on the spiritual side of life. So if you wouldn't eat Erev Yom Kippur and you have to fast on an empty stomach, then the fast would be so overwhelming that you wouldn't be able to get the benefit from it. It would just be something that focuses your attention on your lack of eating and drinking and having these other pleasures. So therefore, God wanted you to eat Erev Yom Kippur. So the fast would not be a terribly oppressive thing, so you could really concentrate by not being involved so much with the physical on the spiritual. And we find this concept that wherever the physical is minimized, the spiritual is able to be emphasized. Okay, the Maharal says it, that wherever we have physical strength, physical power, then the spiritual power of Torah is minimized, and vice versa. So Torah weakens your physical side, but it strengthens your spiritual side. We also find the idea in the Ketores. It says that when the Kohen Gadol, I don't remember where I saw this, I know someone says this, I don't remember who. When the Kohen Gadol would go into the Holy of Holies, so there would be a smoke screen made by the Ketores, by the incense. And I saw someone who says that when your physical sight is impaired, then your spiritual sight becomes more intense. And the Kohen Gadol was going to have to go in there and have a tremendous prophetic vision. So his physical vision was weakened by the smoke screen. And the truth is, the whole idea of incense represents this. Incense is a physical thing that you burn and turn into a spiritual thing, which is basically an aroma. Because the Gemara says, how do you know you make a bracha on aroma? Because kol ha-neshama tahalel koh, something that the neshama gets pleasure out of. It's more of an ethereal pleasure, not a physical pleasure, aroma. And therefore, by taking the physical and reducing it to ashes, you bring out the spiritual, which is the aroma. And it could be for that reason, the Ketores represents uniting all the different forces in the world together. That's spiritual. Unification is spiritual. To unite all the things, even the bad smelling ones were part of the Ketores, and all together they smell good. And it could be that's the reason why the Ketores makes you rich. Because who makes you rich? Because somebody who knows how to take physical things and turn them into spiritual things is a person who should be rich, who should have a lot of physical things to do with it. Also, we find that same idea. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he went up to Har Sinai to get the Torah, so he went through three layers of darkness. Choshech, darkness. Anon, a cloud. And Arafel, a thick cloud. And then he came to the Machane Shechina, into God's realm there, and got the Torah. Now, it would seem just the opposite. You go from less dark, more dark to less dark, until you get to the light. But it seems that Moshe Rabbeinu went dark, more dark, more dark. Because the more that your physical senses are dulled because of the darkness, the more you're able to be aware of the spiritual light that's there. And that's why most prophets lost control over their physical senses and faculties when they prophesied, because the physical side was minimized and the spiritual side was maximized. And that's another thing I saw. I can't remember either where I saw it, but it's that crying, tears, blind a person's physical eye and vision, and give him a chance to see more with his spiritual eye.
And you're crying?
Right, crying, yeah, when you cry positively, when you cry in a positive way, it gives you an opportunity. You're crying about tzaras usually in this world, that if you look at them with the physical eyes of flesh and blood, they look pretty bad. But if you're able to look at them with a more spiritual look, they're not so bad. So the Rav Amram gave us the ability to blind our eyes with the tears, the salt water tears, and have a chance to look at things in a way that's more spiritual than the physical vision. I was thinking that's why the Kohen Gadol goes into the Holy of Holies in plain white clothing, not his golden clothing that he goes the whole year, because we want him to have that tremendous honor, spiritual honor, of going into the Holy of Holies. Clothing gives a person honor. So instead of mixing it with the physical honor of the clothing that's the whole year, he goes in with this minimal physical honor to be able to get the total spiritual honor. There's a Meshech Chochma who says that on Yom Kippur, since the physical things are minimized, the ability to bring the sacrifices, that they should be totally focused on God, is much easier than during the year. During the year, you have to first focus, and then it can be a reich nichoach. Here, it's a the focused on the Rebbe Shalom. So I was thinking, based on all of this, that on Yom Kippur we exchange the physical pleasures with their counterpart spiritual pleasures. In other words, we don't eat. Physical eating, its counterpart is spiritual eating. What's spiritual eating? Torah. Torah, physical food, is the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah. And Yom Kippur is the day that we got, what's it called, the physical Torah. The Torah was given, the Luchos, the second Luchos were given on Yom Kippur, after we were atoned for the sin of the golden calf. So God gave us the Luchos again, the second ones, to replace the ones that Moshe broke. So we have spiritual eating every Yom Kippur. That idea of re-receiving the Torah, the written Torah, comes back again. So we have that spiritual eating, which is intensified by not doing the physical eating. Then there's drinking. Drinking is basically connected to Torah Shebaal Peh. Eating and drinking are the foundation of life, which is Torah. Not only do we have the written Torah, but we have the strength of Torah Shebaal Peh also, the oral Torah. So that those two, the Torah, is intensified on Yom Kippur by desensitizing our physical eating and drinking. Then there's washing. Instead of getting involved in physical washing, we go through a spiritual washing. Titaru, tahara. Tahara, one aspect of tahara, purity, is cleaning off the spiritual dirt. So we don't clean our bodies physically, but we wash them spiritually. We wash our souls on Yom Kippur. In place of marital relations, where the whole relationship between husband and wife is an analogy to the relationship between God and the Jewish people, So instead of having that closeness, that intimacy physically, we have that intimacy with God. And for that reason, on Yom Kippur, they used to make Shidduchim. Because the whole analogy of making that connection between the Ribbono Shel Olam and the Jewish people on Yom Kippur spiritually was represented by this concept of Shidduchim. In addition, we don't anoint ourselves physically. Anointing is an idea of the second idea of Tahara. There's two ideas in purity. One is removing dirt, and the other is shining something up, making it more pure. So on Yom Kippur, we wash our souls, and we also shine them and polish them. Sicha, richitza, washing is taking off dirt. And then putting on oils or whatever is like polishing the body. So instead of washing our body and polishing it, we wash our souls and we polish them. And in the place of wearing shoes, the shoe is the protection of the physical side of a person. Right? You wear a leather shoe, it protects you from all kinds of things that could harm your feet. And the feet are always a symbol of that which puts a person in this physical world. So the shoe is a representation of the protection of the physical body of the person. Ultimate protection of the person, shoes. And therefore, on Yom Kippur, we are protected spiritually. Our neshamas are protected. We're free from the rule of the satan on Yom Kippur. So we are protected on Yom Kippur spiritually. So by minimizing our physical protection of our body, we emphasize the spiritual protection of our soul. So I think that's an interesting idea of how to look at the five afflictions of Yom Kippur as being a trade-off, that instead of maximizing the physical aspect, we maximize their spiritual counterparts. Okay, now a few ideas about sin and the forgiveness of sin. We mention over and over again on Yom Kippur that we are looking for forgiveness for various kinds of sins. One is called chet, one is called avon, and one is called pesha. Now the Mefarshim basically say the following. Chet more or less refers to even unintentional sin. Either that you did it unintentionally because you weren't careful to make sure that what you were doing is okay. Chet, the word chet means you missed the mark. You didn't hit the target. You didn't hit the bullseye. Or chet can also mean chisara, something's missing. Either you missed the mark or something is missing innately. And therefore, chet could even apply to a mitzvah that you didn't do completely. It's missing something. That's why it says, "Ein adam tzadik ba'aretz." There's no tzadik asher yaseh tov who can do total good v'lo yechta and not miss something. No one's perfect. Even the mitzvahs we do lack perfection. That's also called chet. So chet can apply to unintentional sins. You miss the mark. Or it can apply to sins that you do because your desire, your drives, overwhelmed you. You couldn't control yourself. You ate something not kosher because you just had this tremendous appetite for it and desire for it. You couldn't hold yourself back. Now, what's the connection between these two things? So both of them are caused by not controlling your desire. By giving into your desire. Now there's two kinds of desires. There's a positive desire, appetites, that overwhelm a person. There's another kind of desire a person has. He doesn't want to be serious. He's not interested in doing things with a lot of thought. He just wants to do. That's also a desire. A desire to make things easy. You know, not to complicate his life. So the first kind of sin, unintentional, means I didn't really contemplate before I did something, is it 100% okay? What's an unintentional sin? You woke up Shabbos afternoon, you thought it was Sunday. You didn't know that this thing is prohibited. Now what leads a person to do that? Because if you really would have thought about it and said, you know what, I better not do anything until I find out if it's Shabbos or not. Today, I turned on this tape recorder. I should have thought first, let me make sure. Is today Shabbos? Am I allowed to do this? But it's not convenient and comfortable every second along the way to start thinking all these things. Just do. So that's also a drive. It's also an appetite. An appetite to have an easy life. Not to complicate things. And that, giving into that, leads to unintentional sins. So when you give into your other drives, it's very similar. So it's not 100% that you did it on purpose, because you had this mitigating factor of a drive that, what's it called, that caused you to a certain degree. You could have controlled it. So you're not exempt. But it's less something done on purpose. Then there's avon. Avon is a sin that you do because you made a mistake intellectually. It's not that you have these emotional, material drives, but you made a faulty, a crooked cheshbon. You had a faulty thought system, and you came to do this sin because you came to a conclusion that was not right. That's also, to a certain degree, not 100% on purpose, because you, again, here there's a desire to think what you want to think, to go after your thoughts. There's a desire not to accept authority of what's right, but what I think is right. So it's also mitigating. Then there's pesha. Pesha is total rebellion. I know it's wrong. Nothing overwhelmed me. I didn't care. Either I, what's it called, denied the fact that there's any truth to all of this, or I knew that it was true and I didn't care. I just did it anyway. That's the worst kind of sin, pesha. That's called rebellion. Now, how do you get forgiven for these sins? What is the slicha, mechila, kapara? Slach lanu, mechal lanu, kapir lanu. What are these terms? And the goal is to have tahara, to have purity. And we said already, purity has two parts to it. There's the taking away of the dirt, that's cleansing, and then there's polishing and shining. That's also tahara. Tahar can mean pure, shiny, or it can also mean clean. So we clean ourselves off, and we shine and polish ourselves. That's the tahara. And in fact, one of the mefarshim says that tshuva is not like putting a patch over something. It's like getting completely new garment, like getting completely new person. It's a total, what's it called, hischadshus, total renewal, not just a patch. And the word tahara has a connection to the following words, Rav Shamshon Feuerherz says. Tur. Tur means to line something up, right? So when you get purity, things are lined up again. They're straight. Till then, they were crooked. The dirt and the non being not polished is certain crookedness. As something that is tahor is ready for absorption. There's harmony, right? All the idea of not being tahor is there's no harmony. And tahor also has a connection to dohar. Dohar means to move, to appear in motion. People are on the move. They're not stagnating. They're moving ahead. That's tahara. That's the goal, right? To be pure, cleansed, and to have that tremendous shine and polish of that closeness to the Rebbe Mishalov. Now, shlicha, how is that done? So first is shlicha. Some say that shlicha, let me first start with the other way. Shlicha, there's two aspects to every sin. There's the innate blemish that the sin causes in the person, right? And then there's the fact that you rebelled against God and you abrogated or harmed your relationship with Him. So one aspect of sin is in the relationship between you and God, and the other aspect is in the relationship of the sin to you, right? That it caused you a break in your relationship with God. And or it caused you harm. It's like a poison, the sin. It's a blemish within your soul. So on the one hand, they say that slicha refers to getting rid of the blemish of the sin. And mechila refers to God being mochel, pardoning the affront to him, the rebellion against him. One is like the king pardoning you, and the other one's like the doctor healing you. Now, in that respect, slicha, some say, only delays the punishment. It doesn't take away the sin always. It delays the punishment. Whereas mechila always affects something immediately in the sin itself. Based on what we said, you can understand that. If a person does tshuva, and then he gets slicha, so with the tshuva, the slicha will take away the effect of the sin, the poison. But if you don't do tshuva, then God sometimes can forgive you as a doctor will give you like some kind of antidote that won't take away the poison, but it'll delay its action. So if you're ready to be healed because you did tshuva, then the slicha will heal you. If not, it will delay the effect of that poison to give you time to do tshuva and get the antidote. In other words, sometimes they come, lo aleinu, you know, with the emergency. They don't heal you, but they give you things that you'll be able to last till you get to the hospital. They'll give you enough things to keep you going until they can get you to the hospital and operate or give you the serious medicine they have to give. So the first aid is sometimes the slicha without the tshuva to give you the ability to do tshuva. But mechila is always God pardoning you. So it always helps something in the relationship. We're not talking about clearing out the poison. We're talking about patching up the relationship. So if God is willing to pardon you without the tshuva first, it accomplishes something, the mechila. It takes away some of the ill feeling between God and you because of the sin. Now the word slicha, based on this, has a connection to the following words: success, tzlach, progress, sending something. It all has to do with the thing itself. It's an essential kind of thing. Now you become successful because you were a failure because of the sin. The sin made you sick. It made you a failure. It inhibited your progress. Now you can progress again. That Balatanya says that slicha is where God shows that he's not angry with you anymore. It doesn't necessarily make you any better with your relationship with God. It just takes away the poison, we said. So if you take away the poison, you're not ahead of the game, you're just not behind the game. It doesn't make you better, it just takes away the negative. So now God's not angry with you, because when you have that poison in your system, the blemish of the sin, that's God's anger. So now he's not angry. It's also an idea of washing away the sin, but washing away the dirt of the sin. Okay, therefore there's also an idea of jumping over something and proceeding. You jump over the obstacle that the sin was, you get rid of that obstacle, and now proceed on. Till now you have this obstacle holding you back. Okay, and that's why shlicha can have this idea of holding back the punishment. Because again, it's like the first aid. It can either be the actual cure, or it can be something that delays the effect of the poison until you'll do tshuva and then have the cure. Okay. Then there's mechila. Mechila, we said, is the idea of pardon, where it comes from God to you, not necessarily from God to the sin, to the poison of the sin. It's your relationship with God. Therefore, every pardon affects something immediately. Because if God is willing to pardon you, that means that he's not as angry with you as he was before. He's not as distant from you as he was before. And where does it come from, the word mechila? So it can come from the word mechay. To wipe away. So in other words, God takes the sin which is before him, which is like a mechitza between you and him, and he pushes it away. So it doesn't separate between you and him anymore. Okay? That's one idea. Or mechila comes from the word halal. A mechila in Hebrew means a cave. Hollow, something hollow. halal is a dead body because it doesn't have any neshama, it's hollow. A flute is a chalil because it's hollow. The outer space is called halal, right? Because it's hollow. So this hollows out the sin, meaning it's like a cave. Until now you had a mechitza that separated between you and God. So you need to remove that mechitza. So you can start by hollowing it out and make it only a thin facade, and eventually the walls will fall down. So if you hollow it out enough and you take it out enough, there's nothing separating between you and God. So it hollows out the sin. And that we learn, it said, and that is now, it's a positive thing. Because it's not just taking away the distance, it's making you close again to God. When you only repair the poison of the sin, so now you don't have the poison. But that doesn't make you any better. It doesn't make you polished. But when God says, look, until now you were distanced from me, now I'm going to bring you back closer to me, so now it accomplishes something positive, not just takes away something negative. So that shows the love that God has. And therefore, the Rambam says, Mechila has the connotation of leaving something, pushing it away. Right? You leave that bad relationship and renew a good relationship. You leave those barriers between you and God and tear down those barriers. Now what is kapara? After you have slicha and mechila, so there has to be some compensation. Okay, now you're healed, but that poison has to go somewhere. It has to be somehow compensated for. You had a bad relationship with God, the mechitzas were taken away. They had to go somewhere. They can't just disappear. So kapara is always compensation. This in place of this. And therefore it's a ransom, a protection, a cover. Right? It wipes away the sin. So what is kapara? Kapara are those things that accompany the forgiveness and somehow give it away to be compensated for. Davening, karbonos, are things that accompany the forgiveness and give a chance for those negative things to then be totally taken away. For instance, you have, sometimes in along with your kapara, along with your slicha mechila, you need your surim, you need to suffer. But if you daven, so the davening takes away the suffering. If you bring a sacrifice, you take away suffering. Yom Kippur takes away the suffering. So there has to be some compensation, but this will take the place of that compensation. And therefore, there's another though concept of kapara, and that is that kapara can sometimes come before the tshuva, before the shlicha and mechila. Sometimes it's a result, an accompaniment, an extension of the shlicha and mechila, and sometimes it's a preface. How so? You need something to put the sin in a status where it can be forgiven. Sometimes the sin is so great that it's like, you know, I always compare it to a garment that's stained. If the stain is minimal, you put it into the washing machine with detergent, and the detergent takes out the stain. But sometimes the stain is so set in the garment that the detergent can't take it out. So what do? You have a pre-soak. You pre-soak the garment, but that doesn't clean it. That just makes the stain in a position, changes the status of the stain where it's loosened, and now the detergent can take it out. So you still need the detergent. The pre-soak is not going to clean the garment, but it's going to prepare it for cleaning. So sometimes the kapara is a sacrifice, is Yom Kippur, is suffering, things that will take the sin and put them in a status that now you can do tshuva and the slicha and mechila will take effect. It's a pre-soak, the kapara. That's another aspect of kapara. Now therefore, basically what we said is that slicha is to a certain degree applies to the sin itself. So that only happens to Jewish people. To take away the blemish of the sin, that's a special nace, special miracle that God gave us, that by saying we're sorry and we won't do it again, the blemish of the sin goes away. That's special to the Jewish people. On the other hand, that God will forgive you and pardon you for rebelling against Him, that applies even to the non-Jewish world. So mechila applies even to Goyim, and that's the king, and to Goyim, God is the king, and the king can pardon. But when it comes to Slicha, we always say, Shlach Lanu Avinu, Father. That's only the Jewish people's relationship to God as a father and a child. And therefore, Slicha is something that only applies to Jews. The Goyim can do tshuva, but the blemish of the sin doesn't go away. The poison's still there. God will pardon them as the king, but not as the father who heals them from the effect of the sin completely. And that's why Slicha, once you take away the poison, there's nothing there left. But Mechila, God can pardon you, but the sin's still there. So you sometimes need to suffer, even though you get Mechila. Because God will pardon you, but the effect of the sin could still be there. Okay, and therefore, some of the ideas of tshuva is, another idea of Yom Kippur is, that after you have the slicha, the mechila, the kapara, could still be that you need to suffer a little bit to get the total effect of the sin away and to square you away completely with God. So some sins, in addition to everything, need yisurin. But it could be Yom Kippur. If you suffer a little bit on Yom Kippur, it takes that also. So Yom Kippur is not just, like we said, a cessation, a rest from these things, but it's also a little suffering. So the little suffering takes the place of cleaning out the Avera completely. And therefore a person has to be tremendously happy on Yom Kippur. One of the happiest days of the year. I always like to compare it. For women, this is a great mashal. If you had no access to water and soap for a year, and you were dirty, grimy, greasy, sweaty for a year, and then somebody said, there's a shower available, and here's soap, and you went and took the shower. At the same time, you're getting all this grime and grease, you'd feel, ugh, right? At the same time, as you rinse off, you would be elated. I always say that's why when we say vidui privately, personally, we're crying, we're you know, upset, getting all this dirt over our out of our system. But when we say the vidui publicly after that, right, it's like rinsing off. You're singing in the shower. That's why we sing the vidui. Right? Why are we singing? Because you would know how you feel after a year of rinsing off all that dirt. You would be exhilarated. You'd be singing in the shower. So that's what we do. We sing the vidui. It's like taking all this dirt and rinsing it off and getting it off out of our system. So you have to have tremendous simcha on Yom Kippur. Hold on a second, let me finish this. Once a person does tshuva, then God definitely will forgive. The slicha, the mechila, the kapara will follow. And that's why right after the bracha of tshuva, we immediately say slach lanu. And the Balatanya points out, it's not even a doubt whether it's a bracha that you can say or not. If you did tshuva, don't worry, God will forgive you. You should be batua. You should be sure that he's going to do it. At the same time, you should have a certain amount of humility and be subdued. At the same time, be very happy that you know that the effect is going to take effect. And even though doing tshuva will affect forgiveness, God wants you to ask for the forgiveness. He wants the angels to be involved, says one of the Mepharshim. Right? And according to how much you want that forgiveness, that's how much you're going to get it. Solachti kidvarecha. I will forgive you according to your words. Meaning, as much as you really want to be forgiven, that's how much the forgiveness will take effect. And therefore it says that God is the mar belisloach. He does it in a way that is extreme. He's the extreme forgiver. That means he does it over and over again. He'll cleanse us and forgive us over and over, more than we ask for. If you ask, God will give you more than you ask for. And also he gives us many ways of affecting that forgiveness. Yom Kippur and Karbanos and Tefillah and all these different ways of affecting our forgiveness. And not only are we happy when we're forgiven, God's happy. It's like a father hasn't seen his child for a long time. He's been banished somewhere, whatever. He's been in prison somewhere. Finally he's let out. So he's happy to see him. And he's also happy that now the child is obedient. So God is happy on Yom Kippur because we've come closer to him. And also we're well. We've healed ourselves from all the blemishes and the poison of the sin. And we're obedient again. We're doing his will. So that makes God very happy. that he sees a healthy child who's back together with him and obedient. And if we would understand, if we would recognize how much we improve our soul when we do tshuva and put it on the same level as fully righteous people, if we could see it, we would rejoice unbelievably. That's how you have to feel on Yom Kippur. Now going back, one more point is the point of mechila. The word mechila comes from the word mecholalecha. God who either brought you out of the womb, it's also a hollow place where you're born, and therefore mecholalecha has is a euphemism for a mother. And God made you with all the different hollow places in you, all of the open places or whatever that you need. And God took you out of Egypt with dancing. And he is the cause of your mother and father. And he made you into another idea, Macholalecha, is he made you into a jewel. You are an ornament to him. Right? So all of that represents the fact that when God forgives you, he goes back to his relationship when he took us out of Egypt, when you were born, to the those that brought you about. All of that was perfect. The perfect relationship. Right? We started out pure. And we dirtied ourselves and we distanced ourselves from God. So it's going back to the basics, going back to the initial state of closeness to God. And another idea of mechila is it comes from the word circle, dance. When you have a good relationship with somebody, it's like a full circle. Their part, your part, circle. When you destroy the relationship, you destroy the circle. So mechila is making that circle come again, full circle, the relationship is repaired. Those are some ideas of what mechila, slicha, and kapara is, what kind of sins, and how a person should feel on Yom Kippur. Yes?
So if we're supposed to be happy on Yom Kippur, what is the... What's the attitude you have as far as crying and...
Yeah, because you can have both things. When a person... I'll give you a personal example. I find it very hard to cry. Okay? I think some men are like that. I can't say most men, but okay. But me
not
for sure.
Huh? Not most?
I haven't asked them most.
No, I...
But I... very hard. I only find myself to cry when the Yetzer Hara doesn't stop me. Like when you read a novel that has no meaning at all, then I find myself maybe crying at the end or whatever. But when it's serious things, there the Yetzer Hara doesn't want you to cry, there it's very hard to cry. So, and it says somebody who doesn't cry sometime during Aseret Yemei Tshuva, got to check his soul if he's still really alive. Right? How can you not cry during Aseret Yemei Tshuva? Sometimes I come on Yom Kippur and I haven't cried yet bechalal, and I'm really getting scared. But somehow, I don't know why, but the avoda on Yom Kippur, right, gets to me. And for a few seconds, sometimes, I find that there are tears. And I feel great. Now I'm crying, at the same time, knowing that that's what you're supposed to be doing, and the result of it, what it is, makes you very happy. So you can cry and be happy at the same time. You're crying and you know that that's what you should be doing, and maybe you're very happy that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing.